Okay. So when Pierce told me I had to do one of these things, I thought, well, this is a big diverse audience here. We thought, I thought my sociology high PC talk might be interesting, but unfortunately, it's only effective with a PowerPoint presentation. And so, being confined to the blackboard, I thought I should do something more related to what we're actually trying to do here at this conference. So this is a subject near and dear to my heart, but I've never given a talk on it before, so we'll see how it goes. And if my writing is illegible, let me know. One of the bad things about working in a national laboratory for the last 20 years is you don't teach, and so you don't use a blackboard. Okay. So, especially for people from quantum field theory, I think one of the interesting things in this is these quantum phase transitions that we try to describe are basically, at the simplest level, they're bosonic theories. But the real systems have fermionic degrees of freedom underlying it. And this is what is thought to be the central problem in the field. And I remember one of my colleagues, Catherine Pepin, has this nice story. She works at Saclay. When she went in there and talked to Zen Justan, who's, of course, written this major book on quantum field theory, and started explaining some of the problems we were having in the field, as soon as she mentioned the word fermion, he started like, oh, fermions. That's a wholly different matter. And I think this is sort of what we're faced with in this field. So there's a famous equation due to Landau, and its generalization, which my colleague Ginsberg was involved in. And people may be aware of this because I think in field theory limitation, this is known as phi to the fourth theory. And this is for this work that Ginsberg got the Nobel Prize, the previous one to David here. And it's a very simple theory. The free energy of the system is taken to be this simple form. And M is some underlying order parameter. And this seems rather trivial nowadays, but back then people were trying to struggle about how to describe different phases of matter like solids, liquids, and gases, ferromagnets, superconductors, and the ideal of the order parameter was what generalized all this complicated stuff in the system could be condensed into a field known as the order parameter that describes the nature of this microscopic state. And at this original level, it was Landau, and it was generalized by Ginsberg by putting in field, the dependence on the magnetic field, etc. And one of the first successes of Ginsberg-Landau theory was a prediction by Albert Krassoff of a new type of superconductivity known as type 2 superconductivity, which involved inhomogeneous states where the magnetic field penetrated the sample in the form of vortices. And that was the reason Albert Krassoff was also in this Nobel Prize back in 2003. Okay? So at the mean field level, this system turns out to be very simple. This coefficient A and mean field level depends on T minus TC. TC is the ordering temperature. And this is a mean field transition temperature. And this is Landau theory. And I guess in the field theory context, one has similar things where the role of M is played by the Higgs field. Okay. Now, you can generalize this thing. And one of the first generalizations you can do is basically put in spatial degrees of freedom. This is a homogeneous, at this level, these are constants. And this is a homogeneous theory. And when you put in inhomogeneity, and of course, there's the M to the fourth term as well, but typically the spatial dependence of this is not very important. And Xi is known as the coherence length, and Q is a deviation from ordering wave vector. So really by Q, what you mean is Q minus Q, where Q is the ordering wave vector. And this ordering wave vector is in momentum space, and for a superconductor or a ferromagnet, Q is equal to zero. And for something, say, like an antiferromagnet, Q is non-zero. Okay. All right. Now.
At this point, you're summing or hitting negative Q, right?
Yeah, I want to get to that part. Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to use field theory notation here that there's assumed integrals in front of all these things, integrating over spatial degrees of freedom, and when I put in time degrees of freedom, that as well. Okay. Now, of course, we know that mean field theory doesn't work very well, and fluctuations are important, and you can, there are very simple ways of doing fluctuations. One is known as putting fluctuation at the Hartree level, and this is a basis, actually, for the successful theory of magnetism, which were derived by people like Maria and Lazarus and people like this, and works reasonably well for a lot of systems that we know of interest. And the ideal is the following. You could decouple this into the fourth term, and the ordered phase, of course, will be like this, but if you look at fluctuations, there'll be terms of this form, m squared plus m squared. So this is a fluctuating part of the order parameter, and this is the ordered part of the field. And when you do this, what happens is this A term gets renormalized. A, and there'll be, in this term, there'll be a B m squared term. And this renormalizes various properties like the transition temperature. If, for instance, in two dimensions, in many systems, you can show the transition temperature gets forced to zero. This is known as the Mermin-Wagner theorem. And the reason why is the fluctuation correction has become so large that it drives the temperature to zero. And for classical phase transitions, this m squared term is basically some integral of the Bose distribution function times the dynamic susceptibility. So there's some dynamic susceptibility associated with the order parameter field. This is the imaginary part of it. This is the Bose distribution function. And in the static limit, this thing turns to be remarkably simple. It's just an integral of chi of q, the static susceptibility at zero frequency integrated below some cutoff momentum. And this is the basis of classical mean field theory, and this has been heavily studied in lots of systems, okay? So you understand at this point, there's all we have is bosonic degrees of freedom. And then the question is, what about dynamics? And the dynamics now is that instead of this term, here's your static term, here's your local, spatially independent term. You have a spatially dependent term defining a correlation link. And then there's some additional component. So now we have A, Xi squared, Q squared, and now we have some damping term, I alpha omega. And omega is a frequency. So this defines dynamics in the system, okay? And so what happens, the systems that we're interested in are so-called quantum phase transitions, where the dynamics cannot be ignored. So the ideal is in a classical, let me have some tuning parameter here, and this is temperature versus some tuning parameter, and in here I have some ordered phase. And what we know is, in fact, the dynamics are not important around the critical field, around the critical temperature, and this is because the important energy scale of the problem is the temperature. The mean field, the actual ordering transition temperature is the critical energy scale in the system. And the dynamics is not important when you try to divide critical properties. And of course, there's a huge theory for this, which was developed by people like Wilson and Fisher and Kadanoff. And this is a basis for this getting critical exponents near ordering transition temperatures. But when you drive the transition temperature to zero, then these dynamic degrees of freedom, basically quantum mechanics, can no longer be ignored. And there was a very important paper in the field that defined this, and this paper was done by John Hertz back in 1976, and there was an elaboration of this done by Andy Millis in 1993. And what they realized was the following. In classical transition temperature, as you know, all the critical phenomena are determined by whatever the dimension is. And for the spite of the fourth theory, as you know, the upper critical dimension is 4. What it means is beyond 4 dimensions, mean field theory applies. Below 4 dimensions, one has to have corrections of mean field theory, and this is the basis of the epsilon expansion in field theory, was to try to get at this. Okay? Now what happens in this around this quantum critical point where you've driven the transition temperature to 0 is dynamics can no longer be ignored. And what you find is the system behaves as if it has an effective dimension d plus z, where z is a dynamical exponent. And the dynamical exponent depends on the relationship between frequency and momentum. So typically, really what you're saying is that time counts as an extra dimension. So naively, you would assume that z is equal to 1, that the effective dimension would be 3 spatial dimensions, say, plus 1 time dimension, if the dynamics becomes important. What happens in real systems is that, in fact, there's a relationship, and what happens, say, in anti-ferro magnet or a superconductor is Z is equal to 2, and the reason why is alpha is essentially a constant, so there's two powers of momentum for each power of frequency. And what happens in a ferromagnet is, in fact, alpha. In a ferromagnet, alpha is proportional to 1 over Q. So, in fact, it's even worse in this case. For a ferromagnet, the Z is 3. That is, each power of frequency counts as 3 powers of momentum. Now, the interesting thing about this is notice that we live in 3 spatial dimensions. So, if I take systems of interest like antiferromagnet, superconductor, ferromagnet, at Z equal 2 or 3, 2 or 3 plus 3 is 5 or 6. I'm above the upper critical dimension. Mean field theory should work spectacularly well. It does not. Experimentally, system really violates mean field theory. Yes?
The statement that mean field theory works on 4 by 5 doesn't use the fact that you have a rotational symmetry in space, but here your time is not included in the rotational symmetry.
Well,
I'm a field theorist, I'm sorry, so, but
well,
the reason that for you say right. that 4 is the upper critical dimension,
right.
that you can write the kinetic energy as the Q vector square,
yes.
with the same weight for X, Y, Z, and Z prime in 4 dimensions.
Right.
But in that case that you describe there, it looks to me that you do not have the symmetry which includes omega. It's not 6 dimensions.
No, but what I'm trying to say is the following, that if you go through all the machinery like you do for the machinery classical phase transitions, and you look at the scaling properties of the system with dimension like you would do in classical transitions, then what happens is D effective plays the same role as D. I'm not saying that space and there's a symmetry relationship between space and time.
No, but what I'm questioning is that the topology, I mean, because it comes from basically having a default Q over the Q squared being just divergent.
Mm-hmm.
Now that analysis of the integral really uses the fact that downstairs you have Q vector squared. But if you had d dq d omega divided by Q squared plus omega to some crazy power, the analysis would be different, right? It's a very naive question. I'm just trying to see, to calculate in my head.
The shift is the upper critical dimension. That's what you're saying, the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. No, but, if,
no,
but then I guess the question, because if you write down a one loop diagram, two propagators,
mm-hmm.
a height, it's logarithmically divergent in 6 dimensions for a ferromagnet?
No, it's finite when D effective is above 4.
Right.
D effective is D plus 3,
yeah.
say.
So,
like D is the little bit of spatial dimension, so you're above.
Yeah, it's not obvious that this one loop diagram is finite above,
it's finite in infrared. Infrared above D effective.
I think the ideal here, and you're going to see from this talk that I am not the theoretical expert that some people are in the audience. And sometimes I'm mistaken as an experimentalist. But my attitude here, the question is whether this is an irrelevant variable or not, this higher order term. And there are, of course, other expansion terms. So this is simply what I mean by this. Catherine?
The experiment
mentioned is very only at T equals 0 because at finite T, in the omega sector, you are like you do scaling in finite size systems with an isotropy in the time sector and equals 0 or 2. So what she's saying is this basically is like imaginary time. And basically the length scale is determined by the inverse of the temperature. So this thing only becomes infinite. For people to understand, the spatial correlation rate diverges when you go to here. This is why the short distance physics is not important. But what happens in the quantum case is that this thing only diverges, the scale of this thing, the length scale of this thing is determined by the inverse temperature. So as Catherine says, it only diverges in the t equals 0 limit. So this analogy only becomes exact at t equals 0 for that reason. Otherwise you have finite scale corrections. Okay, so the reason I'm just bringing all this prehistory up is the fact that this thing just spectacularly fails in experimental systems, okay? That is, mean field theory type description actually does not apply. And moreover, you can, one of the easiest ways you can see this is in the dynamical susceptibility. So we know in mean field theory what the dynamical susceptibility looks like. In experimental systems, it is grossly violated. So one thing that's been discovered in a lot of systems of interest, if you look at the imaginary part of the dynamic susceptibility, it's oftentimes found at the critical wave vector, I'll call it Q here. There's a function of omega over t times t to some exponent. And this quantity in field theory language is known as hyperscaling and should not happen above the upper critical dimension. And in fact, this hyperscaling form has actually been spectacularly observed in a number of systems of interest. So that's one thing, that you observe this type of scaling relationship, which should not be valid according to the standard theory. And the second thing is, in a typical system we know, most systems we know, the spin degrees of freedom typically are Lorentzian-like. That means alpha is equal to 1, but in the systems of interest, alpha is actually less than 1. And for cerium copper 6 material that our co-organizer here, Hilbert, has worked extensively on, this alpha is actually turns out to be 3/4. The system that was worked out, gold here, X. Systems that were first studied by my lab, which is palladium, uranium, copper 5, alpha is even worse, 1/3. When Brian Maple was here last, a couple weeks ago, looking at this system, and alpha is even 1/5 in this case. So there are a lot of things going on in this system that are not well understood. Okay. All right. So that's one specific remark. Another general remark is the following. Typically, what you mean by this system, you have some tuning parameter which you use to tune the transition temperature to 0. So this is temperature, and this is some interaction constant.
So in these cases, it would be the doping?
Yeah, so in these cases, it's been the doping. It can also be done by magnetic field, by pressure. And so they're actually right. In fact, one of the interesting things in the system is oftentimes you're not quite at the quantum critical point, and there is some tuning parameter, but it sits off the physical plane. And this is one of the problems you have, is that a lot of systems are near but not at a quantum critical point and cannot be accessed physically. So typically what the standard diagram is given for the system is you have an ordered phase here. And you have something on the other side which is given the fancy name of quantum disordered phase. And maybe I'm too much of an experimentalist here, but I think quantum disorder for me just means a paramagnet. And above this, you often have, and this is where the fermions start to come in now, you have something which we call, which in almost all cases of interest are what we call an NFL or non-Fermi liquid phase. So in fact, what we find in this phase, and this is also known, this is according to the Hertz-Miller theory, this is the so-called quantum critical phase. The fermionic degrees of freedom underlying the system appear to obey non-Fermi liquid relationships. And particularly, if you look at the resistance of the system, you see linear power laws, linear in T, over decades of temperature. And as you know, for Landau-Fermi liquid theory, you should go like T squared. T squared is an analytic term. T is not, because you think of T as modulus T, so it's like a non-analytic behavior. And this is seen in a lot of systems of interest, including high-temperature superconductors, by the way, where you see linear temperature behavior. And the nice thing about heavy fermions is you can go to extremely low temperatures in these systems, and this linearity in temperature actually persists oftentimes to the lowest temperature that people have been able to measure at, which is really, really bizarre. And you always wonder what happens if you really go, can you really, this behavior really persist to zero temperature or not? So this is one thing. The other thing is a specific heat coefficient. In a Fermi liquid, it should go like T. what is often, what is usually seen in these systems is that the specific heat coefficient diverges logarithmically as you go to zero temperature.
It means constant.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay, what did I have here? Yeah, it's a constant. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Sorry. So you have a logarithmic divergence in the specific heat coefficient. Again, what happens is the standard theory, and what you can do is there are ways of calculating these things based on this free energy over here. You do not get these kinds of behaviors to come out. There's some systems, one of them that people are particularly interested in this conference, that at low temperatures, the log T actually turns into a power law divergence, where it diverges like T to the minus one-third behavior. So what it means is the underlying Landau-Fermi liquid theory, which basically the assumption is that the fermion degrees of freedom are Landau-Fermi liquid with corrections, and then you have bosonic degrees of freedom due to the ordering. And these bosonic degrees of freedom are supposedly feeding back into the fermion degrees of freedom. That is, they cause a self-energy for the fermion degrees of freedom, but the assumption is that this is relatively innocuous process. And you can see, in fact, it's not. These are enormous divergences here, which indicates that something funny is going on that we don't quite understand.
Okay. So you have
both degrees of freedom? Well, so this gets back to the fundamental problem. What you've done here, you constructed this kind of theory, is that you've integrated the fermions out. So on a ferromagnet, what you have is a bunch of spins, okay? And if you excite these spins, it basically is a particle hole of excitation. And the ideal is you integrate all this stuff out in terms of an order parameter field, which is basically a bosonic variable. This bosonic variable, in the term of kinds of case of superconductor, would be a Cooper pair of electrons. Okay? And the assumption is that this is a theory, and then if you want to see the effect of the theory on fermions, then what happens is you can say, these bosonic fluctuations feed back into the fermion self-energy. But the hope is that it does not change things. That is, if you did a self-consistency loop and then fed that back onto the bosons, nothing dramatic would happen. And this is, in fact, what doesn't seem to happen in these systems. So the general suspicion that a lot of us has is that when we've started at this point, supposedly we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. That's the general feeling that's going on right now. And that the fermionic degrees of freedom have to be considered more carefully. That you need to look at the underlying thing. So let me give some very simple examples of how this happens. How much time do these things typically last? An hour. Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, I use it as a formula. So yep. There is some energy scale at which you say that you simultaneously are thinking about fermions and the bosons that are made out of those fermions simultaneously.
Okay, so you can understand what happens is that basically the order parameters basically derive from underlying fermion degrees of freedom. But as you go to the critical point, the ideal is, of course, all these length scales diverge. So when the coherence length goes to infinity, and therefore what's going on the microscopic level is not so important. You're jumping the gun. Welko, you're jumping the gun here. So let me go back to this innocuous Ginzburg-Landau theory.
I'm an innocent bystander.
Okay.
So there are other fermions which make them, and other fermions which start
doing. Exactly, yeah. But we'll get into that, okay? I'm trying to go, maybe people think I'm going faster, but I'm actually trying to go slow. Let me go back to this Ginzburg-Landau theory. Now, these things can actually be calculated from the underlying microscopic theory. Now, let me give you a good example as a superconductor, because that was one of the reasons the Ginzburg-Landau theory was constructed to begin with. In fact, we actually know what this thing is. This thing has this type of behavior. It's logarithmically divergent in temperature. Okay? Now, why is this thing logarithmically divergent in temperature? What happens in a superconductor is you're pairing electrons, and you can look at the particle-particle susceptibility. And if you look at the particle-particle susceptibility, this is what it looks like. at the ordering wave vector, which in a superconductor is a zero Q. This Tanch function is basically the sum of two Fermi Dirac distribution functions, and you have a 2 omega in the denominator due to the fact that I'm pairing electrons with the same energy but with opposite, in the same momentum but with opposite spins. And you can see that this integral is actually logarithmically divergent in temperature. Okay? So this is the origin of this thing. So if the phase transition temperature is finite, there's no problem. I can just expand this and I get T minus TdV filled. But you can see that if I drive the phase transition temperature zero, the fact that this thing is logarithmically divergent becomes important. And in fact, the other terms are worse. You can show that the B term diverges like 1 over temperature squared in a superconductor. And the coherence length, the bare coherence length, not the normalized, but the bare one that goes in and begins with Landau theory. Remember, if you remember here, there was an A plus Z squared Q squared term. Diverges like 1 over the temperature. Okay? Why does this happen?
Why do we have this divergence?
Because
in a system of fermions,
right, the distribution of electrons versus, say, momentum, in a free electron gas has a step discontinuity.
I have occupied states up to
some momentum value. Beyond this, the states are unoccupied. And for free electron, this is a Fermi Dirac distribution, which turns into a step function at zero temperatures. And this is the origin of this behavior, because this is singular thing. If I differentiate it, I get a delta function. And this is the origin of, and this is Cooper's original insight into solving these problems of superconductivity. What happens with this discontinuity is the fact that at zero temperature, if you put two electrons in the system, they have to all scatter up here. They can't go into there because the states are occupied. And so in some sense, you could say that superconductivity is nature's way of avoiding having a singular step distribution. Now, what happens in Landau Fermi liquid theory? Of course, interactions change this, but one still always has a finite step. And at zero temperature, this finite step turns out to actually determine most of the interesting problems of the system. And the Landau theory was basically identification that you could map this system to this system because at zero temperature, there was a finite size step here. And so what you could say is in the full electrons, all the interacting electrons, you had a small step, but if you transform to so-called quasi-particle basis, those quasi-particle states would have a unit step. And this is not confined to superconductors. This also happens in certain types of magnets, like nested antiferromagnets, magnets, which I'll get to in a minute. And it's also the basis of the Kondo effect. And most of these systems of interest that people are debating about at this workshop involves Kondo physics. What happens in Kondo physics is I have an F electron, which is a very local electron, sitting in a sea of conduction electrons. And what was known experimentally in these systems is that nasty things happen. For instance, logarithmic divergence in the resistivity. And people couldn't figure out what was going for a long time until Kondo showed that if you went to third-order perturbation theory, then these little singular effects due to these step functions of the conduction electrons drove a divergent interaction. What this divergence actually does is once the interaction gets strong enough at low temperatures, basically you pull off a bound state from the conduction electron C, which screens out the F moment. And this was first solved numerically by Ken Wilson, was one of the reasons that Wilson got the Nobel Prize in solving this problem. So again, in some sense, the underlying physics is that you have this singular state developing at zero temperature where you have the step discontinuity between occupied and unoccupied states. And Mother Nature doesn't like this, and it gets rid of it by various things. So what happens in a superconductor, for instance, is the momentum distribution function in the ordered phase becomes a smooth function of momentum. Right. And it's this effect that drives this kind of thing. So maybe I'm wrong here, but I feel that this is part of the problem. And in many of the systems of interest, you can look at this B term as a function of momentum, frequency, and temperature, and you find all sorts of divergences. For instance, in the case of cuprate, where people are worried about two-dimensional antiferromagnetism, this coefficient has been studied in great detail by people like Joe Wheatley and our fellow organizer Andrei Chubakov. And this thing has all sorts of singularities in it that people feel are responsible for the breakdown of Fermi liquid theory in this context. And interesting enough, around a lot of quantum critical points, there's a tendency to actually develop a superconducting phase very good. which again, may be the fact that you have a singular point here that you don't like, and system screens it out by developing some kind of phase around it, more or less like an event horizon around a black hole, to screen this singularity out and so that it doesn't cause problems for you. Okay? Now, is that... So now I'm going to go to some specific examples. And I want to start with a nice paper. One of our participants is involved in, one of our organizers. There's a paper summarizing a lot of this stuff by, by Piers Coleman, by Catherine Pepin, and Jimmy Alcy, and Ravaz Ramasthili. And all four of these people will be here during the program. And they summarize a lot of the stuff that I've been trying to talk about on the board. Now, so what happens in F electron systems is what most people are interested in. And what happens, what was proven by Wilson and other people, is that if you have a lattice of these F electrons, so if you had a lattice in real space of these F electrons, they're very local objects, and they're immersed in a conduction sea, you can get a Fermi liquid-like solution from this. That was first, I think, demonstrated by Nozier. So the ideal here is the following. What happens is you have a competition. So the competition between the Kondo effect, which would like to screen these moments out, and the fact that the moments, these F moments, interact among themselves, for instance, by the RKKY interaction, so there's a competition. There's a competition between these guys wanting to magnetically order and the conduction electrons which want to screen them out. So the ideal is, again, you have some tuning parameter, and the feeling you have is that you have some ordered phase here where these F electron moments actually order. And then the so-called quantum disordered analog, these F electrons actually become a heavy Fermi liquid. And you have, again, some non-Fermi liquid up here. So this heavy Fermi, so the visual experimental evidence indicates that for some reason the effective Fermi temperature of this Fermi liquid seems to be vanishing at this critical point. And then the system goes in the ordered phase. So the natural thing to assume is the following. What we know from work that many people have done is in this heavy Fermi liquid phase, in fact, the F electrons participate in the Fermi surface. So what is a Fermi surface? I've shown this diagram of the momentum distribution function, and this thing happens at KF, and in three dimensions, this KF actually traces out a surface, and this is known as a Fermi surface. Inside the Fermi surface, one has occupied states. Outside, one has unoccupied states, okay? So here's the ideal, and the ideal here is that maybe the F electrons decouple from the Fermi surface here, and the F electrons participate in the Fermi surface there. So in some ways, why it's non-Fermi liquid up here is the system is schizophrenic, because up here, it doesn't know whether it's going to go into a state where the F electrons participate in the Fermi surface or don't participate in the Fermi surface, and therefore the Fermi surface is changing at this critical point. And the system is like, oh my God, what are we going to do here? And the feeling is that maybe the non-Fermi liquid nature of the thing is connected with the fact that at low temperatures, you either end up in one kind of Fermi surface or another kind of Fermi surface. This is one of the ideals that have been floating around. Now, the ideal is if the F electrons do decouple from the Fermi surface, anything that measures the Fermi surface might change dramatically through the critical point. And what Chimiao and Piers and Catherine suggested was, in fact, if you look at something, say, like the Hall coefficient, you might see a large change in the Hall coefficient. So the ideal is that you have, say, a certain number of carriers participating in the Fermi surface here and another number participating there. So if you look at the Hall number versus, say, this tuning field, you might actually see, at zero temperature, you might actually see a step discontinuity in the Hall number. So this would be pretty dramatic if that's actually what's happening. Now, the first time this has been seen was actually the system that we thought we understood. And this is called chromium. So chromium is known around for a long time. It is the quintessential example of an itinerant spin density wave antiferromagnet. It turns out that the theory for quantum is identical to the BCS theory of superconductivity, for reasons that will be apparent in a moment. And it's a simple transition metal. We thought we understood it. There are, in fact, two major review articles in Review of Modern Physics on chromium. And anything, almost any question you want to know about chromium is answered in this thing. Now, what's known in chromium is if I take the system and replace it by vanadium, I drive the critical temperature to zero. Therefore, I get a quantum critical point if I replace chromium by vanadium. And this only takes a few percent vanadium to do this. And of course, I know that I get a paramagnet out here. So the interesting thing was that these experimentals decided, let's go look. And sure enough, when they did RH inverse, the Hall number, versus X, they found a jump at the critical point. Pretty much like what these people had speculated. So wow, even a simple system that we thought we understood, this dramatic jump effect is happening. Now, it turns out that there was actually a more innocuous explanation for what might be going on. And this has to do with the Fermi surface of chromium. And the question is whether these same factors are participating in all these other systems as well. So let me give you some basic Ashcroft and Merman physics. The Fermi surface of chromium, a momentum space composed of two cubic surfaces. There's two Fermi surfaces which look almost like cubes, and they nest inside of each other. So this nesting effect basically ends up, you get an integral like this one. Instead of particle-particle susceptibility, in a magnet, of course, you want to look at the particle-hole susceptibility. But because of this nesting effect, and what happens in the nesting effect is if you look at this surface and translate it by Q, the first approximation is minus the energy of this guy. So this is an electron-like surface, and this is a hole-like surface. And therefore, when I translate them by momentum, they solve this relationship. And that's why the integral looks like a superconductor. So you get the same kinds of things that you have in a superconductor. All of these coefficients in the Ginzburg-Lanois series diverge as you go to zero temperature. Okay. So in fact, now you can sort of see what's going on.
Is it insulating below the ordering temperature then? Is it perfectly?
Okay, so here's the point. There are reservoir sheets out here. There are other pieces of Fermi surface besides these ones, which are spectators, and people call the reservoir. Okay. Now, the interesting thing is, now you can sit there and say, okay, what happens? Now, what would happen in mean field theory if I had perfect Qs? In fact, the transition temperature would never be driven to zero. And of course, the reason why is that you always have a logarithmic divergence. And this is just like pair-breaking theory for S-wave superconductors. If I look at the mean field transition temperature versus thing, it would never go to zero. So the question, of course, is what forcing it to go to zero in the first place? And naively, you might think is fluctuation effects. But in fact, the fact that these things actually diverge like this is bad news. Because it turns out that what this means is the spin fluctuation becomes harder as you go to lower temperatures. So in fact, it turns out that this nested antiferromagnet is less singular than a normal antiferromagnet. So fluctuation corrections are insufficient to drive the null temperature to zero. And you say, oh, it could be a disorder effect, but people have done this under pressure as well, and you get the same results under pressure as you do with doping. So the feeling is, in fact, what happens is you just get loss of nesting. In fact, what happens in band theory is if you change the hole count, these sheets start to become warped. And of course, as soon as they become warped, this divergence is cut off and it drives this thing to zero. On the other hand, you can now understand what happens is imagine these things were perfectly flat, okay? Now I turn on just a minuscule amount of order parameter, these sheets disappear. In fact, you can see this in pure chromium. You can do field emission above and below the ordering temperature, and you can see huge sheets of the Fermi surface just vanish as you go from above to below the Fermi surface. So the ideal is, in fact, even in dumb band theory, you expect the Hall coefficient to jump very dramatically as you go through the critical field. In fact, what you can prove is a change in Hall number. So in fact, naively you get a jump. As soon as you put warping corrections in, of course, the jump goes away. But the prediction is that the change in the Hall number should scale like the order parameter. This itself is weird. Naively you would assume delta squared. And in fact, when these people wrote the paper, they had assumed that in the standard spin density wave theory, it would go like the order parameter squared. But in fact, it's been known for a long time that in fact the change goes proportionally to the order parameter. A bit strange. It looks, again, like a non-analytic result. But in fact, this has now been confirmed experimentally by pressure experiments. People have done pressure, been able to assess a critical point very accurately, and in fact show that this relationship holds. The Hall number change basically is proportional to the order parameter. Okay? So this system turns out not to be a very good system, also because there's not very much evidence for non-Fermi liquid behavior going on. But a lot of systems of interest, these things could be playing a role. So if you go to the bilayer ruthenates, which was the subject of the conference here. So bilayer ruthenates are ruthenate versions of the bilayer cuprates where you see high temperature superconductivity happen. And what happens in these systems is in this case, the critical point is tuned by a magnetic field. So what happens in this system is the following. There's a critical point at which the system actually spontaneously polarizes. In fact, what happens out here is you have a paramagnet, and then what you get is a field-induced ferromagnet. The interesting thing is you see all these behaviors here. The resistance is T-squared here, it's T-squared here, it's linear in T here. So a lot of these signatures of these quantum critical points that people have seen in the heavy fermion system also seen in this material. Okay? And the question is, what's going on here? And in fact, if you zoom in to the critical point, you find out something very anomalous is happening. It looks T squared T and T squared, the resistivity, until you get to very low temperatures. And then what you find out, in fact, is you have a resistivity anomaly. And so if you look at the low temperature resistance, it has this kind of anomaly. It's low, it goes up, it comes back down again. And the shape of this thing is such, well, okay, we have a mixed crowd here, so I won't say what. There have been some people in the community who named this anomaly, but we won't say it in polite crowds. But the point is, what people feel is going on here is the following. So what happens is critical point actually gets replaced by anomaly, and what they think is happening is the following. That the magnetization versus field actually has two jumps in it. Fermi surface polarizes partially here and then fully polarizes there. And the ideal that people have is the following. The Fermi surface turns out to be very, very near the Brillouin zone boundary. And the ideal is, what means is if the Fermi surface actually touched the Brillouin zone boundary, we'd have something known as a Van Hove singularity. That is, the Dipsius states would be singular, because what happens is if this thing touched, you would go from this situation to this situation. The Fermi surface topology would change from becoming hole-like to, say, electron-like when I went through a critical point here. Again, Mother Nature doesn't like critical points. So the feeling is that, in fact, you avoid this thing by developing something called a Pomeranchuk instability. So the ideal is the Fermi surface would polarize this way. It would be pushed in here and pulled out there. So what would happen is the Fermi surface would distort in momentum space, and one, instead of having a closed surface, would have an open surface where basically it became electron-like in one direction and hole-like in the other direction. Now, this orientation can change through the sample. So if you went to another different region of the sample, maybe it would look like that. And therefore, there would be domain walls between this, and the domain walls cause the resistance to jump up. Then what happens is a falling. Then the system fully polarizes. And then you get a Fermi surface like that. When you went to higher field, the magnetization would jump again, but now the domain walls disappear and the resistance falls back down. So the current speculation, which was published in Science magazine a couple of months ago, was that this might be what's happening in the system. That is, one, basically the Fermi surface becomes unstable at this critical point, and one has a distortion of the Fermi surface which tries to avoid this Van Hove singularity, and it distorts along one axis at this point, and then it distorts along both axes at the second point. And that's a speculation. And this is known as a Pomeranchuk instability. So let me end with a system that that I've been working on recently, which is a bunch of interest in the conference. And this is a system called ytterbium-rhodium silicide. And what happens in ytterbium-rhodium silicide is, again, there's a tuning parameter, which again turns out to be magnetic field. There's an anti-ferromagnetic phase here. There's a Fermi liquid phase here, whose Fermi temperature appears to be vanishing as you go to zero, when you go to this critical point. and there's some very peculiar non-Fermi liquid phase out here. And what happens is in this field, it goes like T, but at low temperature, C over T actually diverges with a Powell law divergence. Now, the interesting thing about this system is the order of magnetic moment is very, very small in this phase, 0.01 Bohr magnetons, which is very, very small magnetic moment. And you might think, well, maybe there's something else. There's a hidden order parameter in the system, but the specific heat anomaly, the transition temperature, actually matches this order parameter. The entropy involved in the specific heat is about 0.03 R log 2. So the end result is that, really, it is a small moment that's ordering. But somehow, the fluctuations associated with this very small moment of phase is making strong non-Fermi liquid behavior.
Okay.
So this Hall coefficient thing was also done for this system. It was published in Nature about 2 months ago. And what they found was the following. The inverse Hall number is 2 in this phase, and it's 3 in this phase. Jump in the Hall coefficient by 1, carrier unit. That's huge, despite the fact that the order moment is only 1/100th of a Bohr magneton. Pretty amazing that such a small ordering effect could drive such a huge change in the Hall number from 2 to 3. And obviously, Piers and Catherine said that this is probably has something to do with F electron localization. I mean, naively, you say, carrier number changed from 2 to 3. I have one F hole. It's a ytterbium system, and I have one F hole for formula unit. Here, the F hole does not participate in the Fermi surface. It's magnetically ordered. Here it does. Natural explanation for a Hall number change of 1. Okay? I've looked into the system, and it turns out that, in fact, the Fermi surface, if you believe band theory, is an incredibly complicated Fermi surface and has some resemblances to the chromium case. And what you have in particular happens is you have two large sheets. One is, I'm going to look like this in momentum space, but in fact it's shaped like a flying saucer, so I'm going to call this a flying saucer. And this has a positive Hall coefficient. Then there's some monster sheet. That is, what happens is this sheet becomes so large it begins to overlap with sheets separated by lattice symmetry, and you get a large interconnected sheet. And this thing actually has a negative Hall number. And these two sheets compete against one another. And what I found is, in fact, this Hall number change can be reproduced by simply moving the F levels around. And what happens in band theory is if you look at a state which has RH inverse of 2 and one has RH inverse of 3, in fact, the difference in the F count in the band theory between these two states is only 0.03 of an F electron, which surprisingly is the same as the entropy change seen in this ordering transition. So one point I'm trying to say is a very subtle change in Fermi surface topology could actually drive large changes in Hall number. So the interesting question is, what does all this have to do with non-Fermi liquid physics? And this is what we're trying to debate here. That is, if it really is a small change in F occupancy that drives such large changes, how does this also drive all this divergent effect? And for those who were here, Catherine Pepin gave a lecture on this. She has a model for how such a small ordered phase could actually drive such dramatic changes in physical properties. And this is based on ideals of looking at new degrees of freedom associated with quantum phase transition points, where you go from a Fermi liquid phase where fermionic degrees of freedom are dominant to a magnetically ordered phase where bosonic degrees of variables are more important. And there's been all sorts of talk, you know, whether the quantum critical point is some kind of supersymmetry point between fermionic phase and a bosonic phase, et cetera. But I just want to give you a flavor about some of the things that we've been debating around here. This is not a solved problem. We do not understand why all these divergences happen. We do not really have a good handle about why Fermi liquid theory breaks down. But the general feeling in the conference is that a bosonic-only theory is insufficient to explain what's going on. That fermionic degrees of freedom need to be invoked from the outset to really understand what's going on in these systems. So let me conclude at this point. Thanks.
What you really mean is that the order parameter among phases is sufficient to respond to transition.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Not that you're going to have very common sense.
Well, in fact, we had a talk about this last week. There is one group who believes that there is a fermionic condensate which is going on in these systems. So what happens with fermionic condensate is imagine a band gets pinned to the chemical potential. Then it turns out there's another solution to the Landau equation, which looks like this. It's a ramp function. The distribution function is constant. It becomes linear and it goes zero. And it varies linearly in momentum between two points, K1 and K2. And they call this state fermionic condensate, where basically a chemical band gets pinned to the chemical potential over a range of momentum variables. And there was a talk last week, which was heavily debated, where this guy, who is a fermion condensate proponent, claims that all these divergences can be explained by this fermionic condensate ideal. We'll see, but it is one of the ideals in the air. And in fact, Catherine's theory, which also tries to explain these divergences, she doesn't have an energy band which is pinned to the chemical potential, but she has one at epsilon versus K. Instead of having, it's like tuning the linear term to zero, it goes like K minus KF cubed. And if you make this assumption of this K minus KF cubed behavior, then you can get some of these divergences out as well. And if you look at the Strontium-Ruthenate scenario, basically the assumption there, what was the driving thing, is the Van Hoff singularity. And the Van Hoff singularity, of course, is where a saddle point in the energy dispersion becomes degenerate with the chemical potential. And that's known as a simple saddle point. Albert Kolsoff has proposed an extended saddle point in the cuprate case, where in fact what happens in a simple saddle point, you have a k-squared variation in one direction and a negative k-squared variation in the other direction. Epsilon versus k looks like this. And his has a theory where you have a k to the fourth variation here and k-squared there. And when you have this, of course, you get power laws and specific coefficient as well. If you had a simple saddle point at the chemical potential, you would have a logarithmic divergence in the specific E coefficient. So there are people out there that think Van Hoff singularities or flat bands or something might be important for explaining some of these divergences. The very peculiar thing about these quantum critical points is also the fact, though, that at a sufficiently low temperature, sufficiently low to the critical point, you would think that the long wavelength modes of the order parameter would take over. They're diverging as you go to the critical point at zero temperature. And experimentally, it's an interesting thing. That regime, if it exists, has not been identified yet experimentally.
You got cut in temperature.
Yep.
And you say you have localized temperature.
Yep.
So you cross this line. What happens to the surface?
You mean when you go across here?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Fermi surface should change.
And then you localize the high temperature? Is that what you're saying?
So naively, what you might say is outside the critical regime here, you might assume the F electrons are localized throughout the thing. But of course, what we know here is the following. At high temperatures, one sees a free ion moment for this ytterbium system. You don't see a moment of a few hundredths of a hundredth of a Bohr magneton. You actually see a free ion moment at large temperatures. So in fact, you see this in entropy as well. Right here at the transition, you see 0.03 R log 2. If you go to high temperatures, you get the full R log 8 that you expect for J equals 7 halves moments. So there's been very little study of actually how the Fermi surface varies with temperature. There have been some positron annihilation studies which indicate some possibility when they've gone from the Fermi liquid phase up here that they've seen evidence for the F electrons localizing from positron annihilation. The positron annihilation experiments are very difficult to interpret. And one of the problems is the main thing you'd have to get at the Fermi surface is the Hassan-Alfin, which is only good at very low temperatures. No. So over most of the temperature range, you see log T behavior. And then Catherine knows where the T to one third cuts in at. Yeah.
On the low lengths, it's not what we really get.
Some of the
log
ones
you can get
on the low temperature.
No, that's not true,
I'm not sure.
But you
haven't seen
material
where you see log.
I think this is the only material where people have claimed a power law, right?
Yes,
but
it's also about in the
Yes?
In fact, there's some Fermions floating around as part of this game. What's the idea for supersymmetry, anybody?
Oh, okay. So the reason is the following. Imagine you want to describe the heavy Fermi liquid, okay? So you have F electrons hybridizing with the conduction electrons. And this hybridization parameter is, if you treat it as a boson variable, you can describe the heavy Fermi liquid phase. This is known as slave boson theory. But for the magnetic phase, it turns out that you want to use to describe magnetic degrees of freedom in the same kind of language, you would use something called a slave fermion representation. So the ideal is you go to a system where you try to represent a mean field level, one representation works as good in this phase, and the other representation works good in that phase. So if you have a mean field description where you have a fermionic thing that works in one phase, a bosonic, what happens at a critical point? Well, one of the ideals that's floating around that people like Cavan worked on is that maybe you have a supersymmetric point where the fermionic and neither fermionic or bosonic descriptions for the ground state work. So maybe you can construct some sort of supersymmetry theory for this critical point. And this is where this has come in at. But I'm not the expert, she is, so you can talk to her.
I mean, you can unify bosonic and fermionic representation of the spin in a supersymmetric representation and write the high energy theory for that. Then you would expect that you break the symmetry by condensating one boson on the left, or you break it on the fermionic side on the right. The only thing is we don't have any large N or anything. I don't want to see the theory.
I think the evolution of Fermi surface on the fermions has to be taken into account. You have to understand it's non-relativistic theory because you have always this parameter k up there. And these fermions can be nasty if you want to do it. As far as wedge is concerned, RG, it's very difficult to do for the systems, and RG, including the fermions, is not done. Non-relativistic fermions, for RG for non-relativistic fermions is not done. You have some anomalies and singularities which are just, even power quantum is not done, actually, for this kind of system.
So in fact, one of the things I want to make for our field theory colleagues is, in fact, a lot of these things, we don't know how to solve the problem. There are some ideas about what the underlying theory should look like, but we don't know how to solve it. And this is his point, that
the fermions are two things. Just to tell you, if you take on the fermion surface, if you take the fermions, problems on the fermion surface are pretty fast. So you think you can integrate them, but you have all the directions, perpendicular to fermion surface are fast, so you can maybe integrate them compared to these bosons. But perpendicular to the Fermi surface are slow. So you could have scattering process which involve the slow fermions, and these ones are dangerous. And the only thing which is dangerous is, I mean, what you were saying, you have imaginary time. And then you could have some processes which are, if you have some poles in some hard plane or not, so it's not so easy to power plant, but I mean, it's not simple.
Yeah. In fact, one of the problems with these simple theories, if you look at a simple anti-ferromagnet again, like I said, the general thing is that there's only one Q vector. You look at scattering on the Fermi surface, then there should only be hot lines on the Fermi surface which are connected by critical scattering. And this is one of the reasons you don't see singular behavior in this Hertz-Miller theory, but it's because these hot lines are insufficient. In fact, what you can show is for transport, these hot lines basically drop out of the problem. This was shown in the cuprate case a long time ago by Fidelina and Rice. So in some sense, you have to find some way of making the entire Fermi surface hot get this kind of singular behavior. In the Chromium case, I showed you how, why this happens. If the system is really, Fermi surface actually has a cube topology than a sphere, then the entire Fermi surface becomes hot. In a ferromagnet, of course, the entire Fermi surface becomes hot too because you have cubical zero scattering. So one of the challenges is you have an anti-ferromagnetic phase, but you would like somehow to make the entire Fermi surface hot. And again, if you have nesting, that's one way of getting at this. And this is why I'm suggesting that nesting might be playing a bigger role in these systems than what people have assumed in the past, but we'll see whether that actually turns out to be the case or not.
So
you think
it's not
many of the
physics, it's nesting?
Well, the point is, most of the work you've seen done in quantum critical literature for anti-ferromagnets, they specifically say we will assume the case where nesting is not involved. Because when nesting is involved, then the fermionic degrees of freedom have nasty things going on. If I have a nested surface, then I have a tendency to develop such a thing. So what happens, in chromium, unfortunately, the susceptibility only develops a cusp. But if, of course, I went to two dimensions, then the susceptibility would be divergent. This is a bare susceptibility before I put any kind of interaction effects in. And this is a whole idea with the strong ruthenators. People now thinking this Van Hove singularity might be playing a role. So the fermionic density, if the fermionic density states diverges, you go to the Fermi surface, then it's very, very easy to generate singularities in the system without having to invoke bosonic degrees of freedom.
And this is the old
three-dimensional, not the... Well, yeah, of course. So this is really a lot of debate. See, some people try to save the theory by assuming two-dimensionality. So remember, this D effective is D plus Z. If the system was effectively two-dimensional, then D plus Z is for an A variant before, and you're at the upper critical dimension, so there will be logarithmic corrections. So the fact that you have a log T maybe is not, in the specific heat coefficient, maybe not so bad. But of course, and what happens, at least in a heavy fermion system, the electronic structure is definitely three-dimensional. The problem is oftentimes the spin degrees of freedom, the reasons which are still being debated, seem two-dimensional-like. And by the way, ruthenates, that system is two-dimensional. The cuprates are also two-dimensional. So this is why one reason that things have not been, this community itself has not settled on it, because a number of people that think that the effective 2D theory might actually apply in the end, and therefore we can save Hertz-Miller's theory. My feeling is that's not sufficient, and especially when you see this, then you're dead, right? I mean, you can't. People in the eyes can correct me, but I don't think you can explain T to the minus one third simply by invoking two-dimensional physics.
But is there any evidence? I mean, last semester we had an exotic phase workshop.
Yeah.
A lot of discussion of exotic phases.
Yes, exactly. So this is interesting. This system, which is, I think is really incredible, the nice thing about the system is stoichiometric. You can make it extremely clean. So one of the problems with a lot of these quantum critical stuff is that the systems are disordered, and that sort of complicates interpretation. But people have driven down to very, very low temperatures looking for some kind of instability, and they haven't seen it yet. Whereas, as you know, in a lot of systems, there's a tendency to put a dome around here. Typically, this dome is superconducting, actually. And we know why superconductors have a nice smooth momentum distribution function. So, you know, divergences and fermions are wiped out by superconductivity. And so, in fact, one thing we know is the nature of the superconducting phase in all the heavy fermion systems is not, that's another unsolved problem that's been around since 1979. What is the origin of superconductivity in heavy fermion systems? And we don't have a good theory for that. The second thing is, again, this anti-ferromagnetic phase is weird. If it was really local F moments, you would assume a Bohr magneton moment. You don't see a Bohr magneton moment. You see a hundredth of a Bohr magneton moment. So that in itself is very weird. In fact, there's a lot of heavy fermion systems floating around where you see magnetic moments of order a hundredth of a Bohr magneton, and the theory behind this is also not understood, why you get such small magnetic moments.
I mean, Sentel and Subrasashtev have been trying to develop ideas suggesting that the anti-ferromagnetism is kind of an afterthought, and really underlying that is some sort of exotic quantum disordered phase. And really, one wants to understand the transition from the Fermi liquid to that exotic quantum disordered phase. And the instability to the magnetism is only operative in that quantum disordered phase, but is, in some sense, irrelevant. Magnetism in some sense, magnetic ordering effects are irrelevant at the critical point. Both dangerous and irrelevant variables. Anyway, that's one of the more far out
reference something we're taking.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't have time to talk about this. In this theory, both these phases are Fermi liquid, right? They're just, right? There's just one's a Fermi liquid and one's a Fermi liquid star or something. Is that
well,
right?
And in the other phase, the F moments, rather than the negative order, are forming a spin liquid.
Yes, exactly.
Which is an exotic type phase. I mean, the conduction electrons are then
right.
Doing
a
Fermi liquid behavior.
Right, exactly. Anyway, I think it's very interesting, at least even from dumb band theory, that one can generate such large changes by such small changes in the occupied F count. And this may have really need to be thought about and taken into account when thinking about what's going on in some of these other systems. There's a tremendous number of unsolved problems, and I think one of the reasons it's like this is there's lots of tension, you know, the cuprate problem is not solved, and there's a lot of theoretical manpower that's been devoted to this. Right. And I could have another lecture.
Working on that explains why it's not
solved.
So in the sociology talk, one of the reasons that the high temperature superconductivity problem may have been not solved, but maybe there's too many people working on the problem. I don't know. you guys have similar discussions in string theory that there's too many guys working on it?
Well, okay. All those people are pursuing one idea.
That
is a problem.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, maybe that's a good safe point.